Dakotra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Dakotra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today, we're immersing ourselves in a truly foundational work. It's Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. It's quite a heavy book in many ways, dealing with absolute despair, but somehow it manages to be incredibly life-affirming.
Oh, absolutely. It's a phenomenal source of insight. And, you know, the sheer power of it really comes from its origin story, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It came directly out of the darkest circumstances you can possibly imagine, Frankl surviving Nazi concentration camps.
Right.
Yet it doesn't focus on revenge or bitterness. Instead, it tackles this huge universal human question: what actually makes life worth living, especially when everything else is just stripped away?
Exactly. And that's our mission for this deep dive, to really distill Frankl's revolutionary core idea, because it was revolutionary. It challenged the psychology of his day. Mm-hmm. He's arguing that our main drive isn't pleasure, like Freud thought, or power, which Adler focused on.
No. Mm-hmm. Frankl says it's this deep, relentless search for meaning. And understanding this idea, this kind of inherent human resilience, feels incredibly essential today, you know, with all the anxiety and just information overload we face.
Definitely. And to really grasp the weight of that argument, you need to know a bit about the man himself, Viktor Emil Frankl. He was born in Vienna, 1905, already an accomplished neurologist and psychiatrist before the war.
That's key, isn't it?
It is, because he'd already started developing his ideas around logotherapy, that's meaning-focused therapy. He actually saw it as the third Viennese school of psychotherapy, following Freud and Adler.
So this wasn't just like an emotional reaction to the trauma. It was a professional framework he was already building.
But,
But then, wow, those theories got put through the most brutal real-world test imaginable. 3 years as a prisoner, 4 different Nazi concentration camps, places like Auschwitz and Dachau. The conditions were just unthinkable.
Unimaginable. And that experience, that's what gives him this unparalleled authority. He was living it. He was both a victim suffering horrific loss. I mean, he lost his parents, his brother, his pregnant wife.
Just devastating.
And at the same time, he was a trained psychiatric observer. He was actively analyzing human behavior, the breakdown of the psyche under these extreme dehumanizing conditions. It gave him a perspective that, frankly, no other psychologist back then could possibly have had.
Okay, so let's unpack the book itself then, because its structure is really important, that dual nature you mentioned. Part one is the memoir bit, right? The harrowing psychological analysis of life in the camps that serves as the sort of evidence.
That's right. And part two is where he formally introduces logotherapy, the theory that emerges from that experience. And the whole thing, the entire work, it rests on this central idea. The core human motivation is the will to meaning.
Mm.
Frankl argues that fulfillment, satisfaction, these aren't things you can chase directly. They're more like byproducts.
Byproducts. How so?
Well, they naturally arise when you dedicate your life to a purpose larger than yourself. You aim for meaning, and happiness sort of finds you along the way. It's not the primary goal.
That makes sense. And what happens when that innate drive, that search for meaning, gets blocked or frustrated?
Well, Frankl gives that a name, too. The existential vacuum.
The existential vacuum.
Yeah, it's this deep, pervasive sense of emptiness, purposelessness. He saw it becoming more common, even back then in modern society. It's that feeling that, you know, even if you have everything material, the good job, the nice house, all the gadgets, something fundamental is still missing. A void.
That sounds incredibly relevant right now.
It really does. Mm-hmm. But the genius of Frankl is he doesn't just diagnose the problem. He offers pathways to meaning. He suggests 3 main ways we can find it, and they're pretty accessible, actually.
Okay, what are they?
First, through creative work or deeds. Basically, the contributions you make, what you build or create.
Right, like your work or passion projects.
Exactly. Second, through experiencing values. This could be through deep connections like love or appreciating beauty, nature, truth.
Okay.
And the third path, this one comes straight from the camps and it's maybe the hardest, but also the most profound. It's finding meaning through the attitude you take towards unavoidable suffering.
Ah, when you can't change the situation itself,
you're challenged to change yourself, your response to it. That's where meaning can be found even in the worst circumstances.
Wow. Okay, let's dive into part one then, the memoir section. Because like you said, that's where the theory is really forged. He talks about three psychological phases prisoners went through, starting with the initial shock.
Yeah, shock is almost too mild a word, isn't it? I mean, imagine the journey crammed into cattle cars, then arriving at Auschwitz, facing the infamous finger game. A guard deciding life or death with just a flick of the wrist.
Instantly. Terrifying.
And you're stripped of absolutely everything. Clothes, possessions, your past identity, even your name. Replaced by a number tattooed on your arm. It's the ultimate dehumanization right from the start.
Gone. Your whole identity erased.
And after that initial overwhelming shock, the second phase starts to set in. He calls it apathy.
Apathy. Like emotional numbness.
Exactly. It becomes a necessary defense mechanism, like a protective shell, just to cope. You regress to the most primitive needs, thinking only about the next scrap of bread, trying to find a bit of warmth. Basic survival.
It makes sense. You'd have to shut down emotionally.
You would. But it's here, in this stripped-down state, that Frankl made a crucial observation. He saw a psychological difference between those who managed to survive and those who just faded away.
And what was that difference? The physical conditions were horrific for everyone.
It wasn't physical strength, primarily. It was the inner life. Frankl himself talks about finding a kind of salvation by mentally detaching from the immediate suffering. He'd have these vivid, detailed mental conversations with his wife, picturing her.
Even though he didn't know she was alive.
Right. He realized that love, or even the memory of love, could transcend physical presence, physical reality. It gave him an inner anchor.
So the focus shifted inwards, or maybe forwards?
Yes, forwards too. It shifted from what they were enduring right then to what or who they were waiting for, what they still hoped to live for. He clearly observed that those who held on to some kind of future purpose, a reason, a why to live, were the ones who could bear the horrific how.
He gives that example around Christmas 1944, doesn't he?
He does. It's tragic. Many prisoners had sort of mentally set Christmas 1944 as the date they'd be liberated. They clung to that hope. And when that date passed and liberation didn't happen, the death rate in the camp apparently spiked dramatically in the following weeks.
Wow.
Their psychological anchor, their why, had collapsed. Hopelessness literally became fatal.
So hopelessness wasn't just a feeling, it was a physical threat.
Directly. Which brings us to the third phase he describes. Disillusionment. This happens after liberation.
You'd think it would just be pure joy, relief.
You would, wouldn't you? But Frankl writes about a much more complicated psychological reality. There was often this feeling of unreality, like, is this really happening?
Mm-hmm.
And then often the crushing pain of returning home, only to discover that the very people who were their reason for surviving were gone.
Oh, God. So survival was just the first step into a whole new kind of grief and adjustment.
A very complex grief. Which actually leads us quite naturally into part two, where he takes all these powerful, painful observations and formalizes them into his practical framework, logotherapy.
Logotherapy. Logos meaning, right?
Exactly. And it's a school of thought that's very much future-oriented. It's not about endlessly digging into the past. The main task isn't asking, what do I want from life? It flips it. It asks, what does life want from me? What is life asking of me right now?
That's a profound shift. It puts the responsibility back on the individual.
Totally. It's about responsibility.
Yeah.
And if that will to meaning gets blocked, if we can't answer that question, that's when we fall into that existential vacuum we talked about earlier.
And you mentioned this vacuum doesn't just show up as sadness.
No. Frankl was quite prescient about this. He saw how meaninglessness could manifest in modern life in various ways. Chronic boredom, certain kinds of anxiety-driven neuroses, aggression, addiction.
It feels like he was predicting a lot of what we see today.
I think so.
Oh.
He argued these aren't always just, say, chemical imbalances. They can often be symptoms of an underlying existential crisis, a crisis of meaning.
That idea of the existential vacuum feels particularly sharp now, doesn't it? When you look at, say, social media culture, where so much is about chasing external validation or curated happiness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It seems like a perfect example of the will to meaning being frustrated and people chasing, well, the byproduct instead of the source.
Chasing the feeling of happiness directly rather than pursuing a meaningful goal that might generate happiness incidentally.
Precisely. And to help people climb out of that vacuum or deal with the neuroses it can cause, Frankl developed specific techniques within logotherapy.
Right. You mentioned a couple earlier. Things like paradoxical intention. That sounds Well, paradoxical. How does that work?
It absolutely is counterintuitive.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the brilliance of it. Paradoxical intention basically involves encouraging a patient to intentionally try to bring about the very thing they fear most.
Could it give me an example?
So, say someone has a terrible fear of public speaking, and their main worry is that they'll start shaking uncontrollably. Frankl might suggest that they go into the speech and consciously try to shake as much as possible, show people how much they can shake.
You're kidding?
Not at all. The moment you intend the symptom, you introduce an element of humor and detachment. More importantly, you often find you can't make it happen on command, which breaks the feedback loop of anxiety. The fear loses its power.
Huh. That's a fascinating way to reframe fear, almost turning it into a challenge or even control.
Exactly. And the other main technique he talks about is dereflection.
Dereflection, so shifting focus.
Precisely. Many anxieties or issues, Frankl noted, especially things like performance anxiety or certain sexual dysfunctions, are actually worsened by hyperintention, trying too hard, focusing too much on yourself and the desired outcome. Dereflection is simply about shifting the focus away from the symptom, away from oneself, and towards something or someone else meaningful.
So get out of your own head, basically.
In a nutshell, yes. Stop agonizing inward over the problem and focus outward on a meaningful task, a purpose, or another person.
You can really see both of those ideas in that case study he mentions, the two suicidal men he counseled.
Oh yeah, that's a perfect illustration. He realized he couldn't just tell them platitudes about loving life, it wouldn't work. Instead, he asked them what life expected of them, what responsibilities did they have.
And one man realized he needed to be there for his beloved child who was waiting for him.
Right. And the other man was a scientist who had a series of books he felt uniquely responsible for finishing.
And that sense of responsibility, that specific why, gave them an immediate reason to live. It gave them purpose.
Exactly. That's the engine of logotherapy right there.
Yeah.
Which leads us really nicely into the core universal themes we can pull from all this. First, obviously, is the will to meaning. We've established that.
Hmm.
Fulfillment is a byproduct of pursuing meaning, not happiness itself.
Right. Chasing pleasure or validation directly often just leaves you feeling emptier in the long run. It's aiming at the wrong target.
It is. The second big theme is the last human freedom. This is maybe his most famous insight.
This is the idea that everything can be taken from you except your attitude.
Exactly. Except the last of the human freedoms. To choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. To choose one's own way.
It's incredibly powerful. But I sometimes wonder, how do we make sure that isn't misinterpreted? Like, it could sound like it's minimizing real trauma or suffering people go through.
That's a really important point. And Frankl himself was very clear about this. He is not saying suffering is good or easy, or that just having a positive attitude magically makes horrific circumstances okay. Of course not. He's simply stating an observed psychological fact. In the final analysis, your inner response, your choice of attitude towards your circumstances remains yours. It cannot be taken away. The locus of control for your inner stance is always within you. It doesn't deny the horror of the external situation. It affirms the individual's ultimate mental sovereignty over their response to that horror. It's the last bastion of human dignity.
That clarifies it beautifully. It's about inner freedom, not denying outer reality.
Precisely. And that leads to the third core theme, meaning through suffering.
This is the idea that even when suffering is unavoidable, like a chronic illness or a profound loss, something you simply cannot change.
Yes. Even then, that suffering can be transformed into a kind of human achievement by the stance you adopt towards it. It allows for dignity and meaning even when practical help or external change is impossible.
Finding meaning in how you bear the suffering.
Exactly. It's the highest form, perhaps, of finding meaning.
And Frankl's writing style itself, it's so direct, so powerful. He distills these huge philosophical ideas into lines that just stick with you.
Oh, absolutely. The quotes from this book are incredibly memorable.
We definitely have to start with the one that sums up survival in the camps. Those who have a why to live can bear with almost any how.
Mm-hmm. It's a direct nod to Nietzsche, but Frankl validated it through his own lived experience and psychiatric observation. It's grounded.
And then the quote that really captures that foundation of human dignity, the last freedom one. Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way.
That one resonates so deeply, doesn't it? It's just fundamental.
It really is. And maybe one more, the one about change.
Ah, yes. The path to meaning through attitude. When we are no longer able to change a situation.
We are challenged to change ourselves. That hits hard. It puts the onus back on us, on our inner world.
It does. So, okay, let's bring this profound wisdom born from tragedy into our everyday lives. How do we actually apply this stuff? I think it really comes down to consciously applying those attitudinal values he talks about.
So when you face a setback, it could be small, like being stuck in traffic, or big, like a job loss or a difficult diagnosis.
Right. The typical reaction is, why me? Why is this happening? Frankl suggests shifting the question. Ask instead, okay, this is the situation. What is it asking of me now? What's the most meaningful, the most responsible way I can respond to this, given that it is happening?
That shift from why me to what now is huge. It moves you from victim to agent, even in a bad situation.
Precisely. And think about applying this in professional life, too.
How so?
Well, for leaders, Frankl's work implies moving beyond just offering bonuses or perks. It's about clearly connecting the work people do to a larger purpose.
Ah, so employees feel their contribution matters.
Exactly. People are far more motivated and satisfied when they understand how their daily tasks, their how, serves a meaningful company mission or ethical goal, the why. It's about fostering that sense of responsibility in the workplace culture.
Makes total sense. People want to feel their work isn't just busy work.
Nobody does. And this links to another key concept Frankl introduced later in his life, tragic optimism.
Tragic optimism. Sounds like another paradox.
It is, in a way. It's about maintaining a fundamental optimism about life's potential for meaning, despite acknowledging what he called the tragic triad of human existence. Pain, guilt, and death. These are unavoidable parts of life.
So it's not blind, naive optimism.
Not at all. It's about facing reality, acknowledging the suffering, the mistakes, the finitude of life, but still affirming life's potential for meaning through our responses. It's courage in the face of pain, self-acceptance despite guilt, and living responsibly in the face of mortality.
Wow, that's a very grounded, resilient kind of hope. You know, reflecting on all this, the thing that really stands out most to me is that counterintuitive truth we started with. That the direct, conscious search for happiness often backfires. It's self-defeating.
Mm-hmm.
But if you shift your focus to searching for and living out meaning, fulfillment, even happiness, tends to arise naturally as a consequence, as that byproduct.
Yeah, you start chasing the feeling and start focusing on the task or the value that gives your life meaning. The feeling follows the action.
Exactly. What about you? What's the enduring lesson for you?
For me, it's got to be that fundamental paradigm shift he offers away from a victim mentality, no matter the circumstances, and towards responsibility. The book is just this incredibly powerful affirmation that through our choices, especially our attitudinal choices, we are ultimately the authors of our own lives. Even when circumstances are utterly horrific, that last freedom, the freedom to choose our stance, remains. It's an unmatched blueprint for resilience and honestly a vital guide for figuring out our purpose right here, right now.
A truly essential read. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.